Trail's insignia. Alex Jones trivia. That new millennia rap, I take it back when it was grittier. Way back when Joey Badass still had a sippy cup. I'm Titty Cassie, the go and slap Diddy up. Drowning amphibian in a Dixie cup. Y'all trash like the city dump. Me and Scatter came to fuck the city up. Like Godzilla, I'm pot killer. Small time pot dealer. Lead leave you dancing with the dead, but this not thriller, don't got Skrilla. Pocket full of nothing, I'm disgusting. It's a pimple full of pus. When it's erupting, yeah, I'm busting. I'm doping the opiates to a Soviet. When I'm rushing the baddest, when I'm blasting like Travis, the hammer drumming, discussing who the hottest. Yo, them, we still above them. Local rappers, I treat them like I never love them. Yo, we run them like they hiding. Every verse that I'm scribing, like Zeus with the lightning colliding, electric sliding.
Now, here's my frustration. I knew they were going to announce global government with this European crisis years ago. It's now happened. I know all of this. I know they're spraying us every day. I know they're spraying my family. I know we're all filled with heavy metals. I know it's hurting us. Moving right along, back to Aaron Dykes, because this is all going on, and you're supposed to just worry about football all day or what Lindsay Lohan's doing. I'm sorry.
Rebel
because what they
are
spraying
radio.
Is brain damaging the population as neurological disorders go off the charts.
Rebel
as the honeybees
Diaz
die.
Radio.
Aaron Dykes continues.
Yo, check this out. This is Chuck, your public enemy number one, the rebel without a pause, bringing the noise and fighting the power right here to the Sights and Sounds. That's right, Sights, 99.5 WBAI.
Headlines abound about the horrors of the current opioid crisis. Opioid-related overdose deaths have become the leading cause of accidental deaths of teenagers, yet every one of them could have been prevented. Addiction knows no bounds. Communities of all stripes are being devastated. Well, to understand the situation, we have to take a step back and a hard look at how punitive prohibitionist policies are a far greater monument to racism in this country than the statue of any Confederate soldier. Join us this Friday, November 10th, from 6 to 8 a.m. on WBAI's Morning Show with Mr. O for a revealing expose of the hypocrisy surrounding the opioid crisis. Our guests include Dr. Carl Hart, author of High Price, and Dr. Jeffrey Singer, Senior Fellow of the Cato Institute, along with healthcare and addictions professionals, for what is sure to be the kind of informed conversation you can only hear on WBAI 99.5, November 10th.
Good morning. You're listening to Health Action over WBAI in New York. I'm Catherine Davis, and we have two segments for you today. In our first segment, you'll be hearing from Mark Hannay, and this is a presentation of his cable TV show featuring an interview with Dr. Oliver Fine, chair of the New York Metro Chapter of Physicians for a National Health Program, about Bernie Sanders' new Medicare for All bill. And coming in the second segment, I will be back, and we will be talking about dance, as a form of healing. So please do stay tuned.
In this month's program, we're going to be taking a look at, perchance, a new universal health care bill that's been introduced into the United States Senate by Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont. It was one of the key planks of his primary presidential run last year in the Democratic primary. And joining us to help us understand what's in the bill and sort of the politics surrounding us, we welcome Dr. Oliver Fine, who's the chair of the New York Metro Chapter of Physicians for a National Health Program. Welcome, Dr. Fine.
Thank you for having me. Yes.
You're welcome. And if you don't mind, I'll call you Ollie during the conversation.
That's fine.
Since
Absolutely.
We've known each other for a while. Before we get into the bill itself and so forth, can you tell people who might not be familiar with the organization's Physicians for a National Health Program who you are, what you do, what your goal and mission is, and
surely,
so forth?
Surely. PNHP, Physicians for a National Health Program, is a national organization with chapters all over the United States. Our membership now is about 21,000 physicians, medical students, and also some health professionals, nurses, social workers, people who are deeply engaged in the healthcare delivery system. Mm-hmm. And our origin is really around the notion of a healthcare for all, a program in which healthcare becomes actually a universal human right here in the United States. And we have a number of proposals that have been, written up. People can go to our website, again, pnhp.org, and there they will see the latest version of our proposal, which is from this year, 2017.
Mm-hmm. And you also have oodles of really good research on topics related to national
Absolutely.
Health programs on that
Absolutely.
Website. So if you want a good deep dive in this stuff, that's a place
to go.
This
is a place to go. Yeah. Absolutely correct.
Right. Right. Good, good. So let's talk about Senator Sanders' bill then. His materials on his website, the executive summary, starts off with it's called the Medicare for All Act of 2017, and it describes its goal, as you indicated, making healthcare a human right. Maybe what's the case for healthcare as a human right?
Well, frankly, it's kind of a necessity for life, right? I mean, we think of other clear necessities for life, food and water, to some degree, shelter. Mm-hmm. All of those things are necessary. But frankly, if you didn't have health care, many people would die much younger. Mm-hmm. And there ought to be access to health care without any barriers to getting that access.
Good. So let's then talk about this proposal. The gist of it is that we have an existing national health program known as Medicare, and the idea is kind of like, let's open it up to everybody.
Exactly. So one of the questions is, how would you become eligible for this program?
Right.
As you know now, eligibility is really only for people over 65 and for people with a lifetime disability. Mm-hmm. What we're talking about here is, that everybody that is a resident of the United States should have this program. So let's say you go to the emergency room of a hospital and you haven't actually signed up for the program. They do their wallet biopsy on you, right?
Okay, yeah.
And find out you don't have any health insurance. Well, what an opportunity. We just will sign you up right here in the emergency room.
Right.
Is there any private insurance company that would sign you up in the emergency room of a hospital? No way.
Right.
That's the difference here.
Right.
It means that, in fact, people have access to this essentially universal program for health care.
And essentially, when a child is born, they're automatically
enrolled. Right, exactly.
So over a generation or two, you get everybody in the program. There's no question anymore. One of the key aspects of this, you mentioned barriers to care. So one of the key barriers to care is, under our current system, is how people pay for their health care.
Right, exactly.
So what does this bill do about that?
Well, the first thing is that it tries to eliminate all financial barriers to care. What do I mean by that? Well, in private health insurance, and even actually in the Medicare program,
as we currently know it,
there are deductibles. What that means is that you have to pay out of pocket cash, before the insurance kicks in.
Mm-hmm.
And frequently there are co-payments,
mm-hmm.
so that you go to the doctor, let's say, and, you know, the doctor charges a certain amount, but you then have to pay an additional amount.
Mm-hmm.
We want to eliminate all co-pays and deductibles. There should be no financial barriers to health care access.
So this would actually be an improvement on the existing Medicare program.
That's what we always say. We talk in terms of Medicare for all, improved Medicare for everybody.
Okay, so I get in the program, either I'm born in it or I'm registered in the ER or whatever, I get on the program because I'm a resident. That's all that's required.
That's right. The other important factor is that it does include immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing that an immigrant has to prove is residency in the United States.
Right. And so I get in the program, so what do I get?
Well, your coverage is extremely broad. All medically necessary services. That means preventive care. That means visits to the doctor. That means hospital care. That means even medications and reproductive care.
Mm-hmm.
Access to all care. Now, this reproductive care is judged to be somewhat controversial,
mm-hmm.
because perhaps it would cover abortion as a health care right.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we in Physicians for a National Health Program feel that that is an important thing that should be covered. So it's a very broad coverage. Now, it doesn't cover one really important territory.
Which is?
Long-term care.
Okay. So that's nursing home, home care in the community, things like that.
That's correct. Nursing home care, hospice care, as you say, in the home, with a home health aide or so on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why doesn't it cover it? Most likely, the reason is that, in fact, the Medicare program today doesn't cover it, and neither does really any comprehensive health insurance.
Right.
So if you were going to make cost comparisons with the present and you included long-term care, you would run into difficulties.
It
would look like it costs a lot more.
Right.
So long-term care will continue under the Sanders bill to be covered by Medicaid. Now, we think, frankly, all of these practical reasons for excluding it should be eliminated, and we really should, because people need long-term care.
Yeah.
They just need it. We should include that in this program for everyone, universal coverage?
Well, my suspicion is that I think probably in principle Senator Sanders would agree with that, but he's looking at how can he get something through the Congress, and maybe it's sort of a thing of let's get this expansion to everybody in place, and we'll sort of figure out how to bring in long-term care as we go.
Uh-huh.
I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt there.
Yes, you can. We would argue, frankly, let's start with what we think we're aiming for and make those compromises later.
And we'll talk more about that because I know you have some personal experience with that whole process.
Yes.
So I've got pretty comprehensive benefits, everything I might medically need, as defined by who?
The bill, I'm not sure, is absolutely definitive about this, but the definition of, what's covered would probably be left up to a panel of people who look at and can study things. Probably a similar situation is drug coverage under the FDA, okay? And there what you have is a set of standards and an entity that would hopefully have public representation on it that would begin to make some of those decisions.
And in fact, the current Medicare program does have an advisory board,
I think. Yes, called MedPAC.
Yeah,
absolutely correct.
The program is updated from time to time because medical treatments evolve over time.
That's correct. Right. And there would probably be a similar entity here, although, again, I'd like to see more public involvement.
Right. Not just the insiders, as
That's
they
correct.
Say. I'm in this program. On the other side of it, in terms of doctors and hospitals and so forth, who's in the program from that angle?
Okay. So in terms of the providers of care, they would declare themselves as participants in the program. And that would be true for doctors, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, hospitals, dialysis centers, so forth. The major defining characteristic, however, of the Sanders bill on this level is that it would not permit private health insurance to duplicate the coverage benefits that are in the Medicare for All bill or Medicare for All program. Okay, you say, well, why not? I mean, because in fact, what happens when you allow private insurance to do this, you begin to erode benefits of having a universal program that covers everybody. What happens is that the private insurers can be extraordinarily clever in excluding very expensive patients, right, and leaving them to the public coverage, which then escalates in cost.
Right.
We see that in the existing Medicare Advantage program, right, where many of the Advantage plans offer free health club memberships.
Okay.
Now, I thought, that's great. I want my elderly to exercise more, to, in fact, be engaged with, programs that really stimulate them and have them do exercise. But the question then is, who is this attractive to?
Right.
Is this attractive to a patient with congestive heart failure that has shortness of breath climbing stairs? No, they don't want to go to a health club, or it's not really what they're about.
Right.
Somebody with obstructive lung disease who gets shortness of breath, people with cancer may find this not so advantageous. And the consequences, again, as I said, that all of this gets allocated to the public program, and the private program.
So then that creates an incentive, really, for the providers to play in the new system.
And secondly, right, you asked the question about the providers and how they would be paid. Sure, there may be some people who decide not to participate in the Medicare program.
Right.
But then they cannot accept any form of insurance that covers the benefits. Mm-hmm. They have to get their money, you know, essentially in cash from the patient. And yes, there are some patients that can do that.
Right.
Right. But frankly, even they will probably want to stay in the national program.
Right. So that's kind of the nuts and bolts of how it works for an individual in the provider system. Sort of stepping back and now looking at our whole healthcare system, what would be the impact of this bill on that?
Well, you know, obviously there would be a profound impact on private health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't mention that, you know, we would want to see the program able to negotiate directly with the pharmaceutical industry for price.
Right. Which we don't
right
do now.
Right now, the Medicare Part D doesn't allow the Medicare program to negotiate for price. Right?
Right.
But what happens then in this system is that the administrative costs of running it really become profoundly reduced. It's estimated that over $500 billion could be saved in administrative costs alone. Now, what do
Which
I mean
no
by that?
Chump change.
That's right. What do I mean by that? Well, if you don't have private insurance companies out there, each, you know, having their own formularies for prescription drugs, each having their own network of doctors that they will compensate, each having their own group of hospitals, you know, they have to have a huge administrative structure to compete with each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have to decide to, you know, deny claims, mm-hmm. you know. They have to have prior approval all the time mm-hmm. for things. But if you had, you know, fundamentally this Medicare for All, which would be, yes, a single payer, a single entity, you know, paying the providers, you would really reduce administrative costs. And that's just on the insurance side. You know, Medicare has probably an administrative cost about 2-3%.
Mm-hmm.
Private health insurance, in order to do all this denial of claims and so on, has about an average of 20% administrative costs.
Mm-hmm.
But there would also be savings on the provider side.
Yes.
I wouldn't need to hire that extra person in my office to deal with all the bills, mm-hmm. right? Hospitals wouldn't need, you know, to have an administrative structure, you know, to deal with the multiple insurance companies. We looked at and compared, you know, the administrative costs that hospitals have in Canada versus the administrative costs that hospitals have in the United States. 25% of dollars collected by hospitals in the United States go for administrative costs. It's about 12% in Canada.
Hmm.
So you could have some major, major savings here. You could go to Medicare for Everyone, including all those people who are uninsured,
right.
all of those people who have high deductibles and high copayments and are therefore underinsured.
Mm-hmm.
You could put them into this Medicare for All program without actually raising the cost overall of health care in this country. You could do it,
mm-hmm.
it seems to me, at the level that we're spending now and maybe a trifle less.
Okay. What about quality of care and access to care? Would we get better care under this system?
I think you would. Why? How does one measure quality today? If you look at virtually all of the quality studies that are done on medical care in the United States, they're done on Medicare and Medicaid data.
Okay.
Because that data is public. That data is data that can be actually researched.
Mm-hmm.
But private health insurance companies don't want to let you get near researching whether they are delivering quality care, because what if one of them isn't delivering as good a quality of care as another? They would then become uncompetitive mm-hmm. in the market.
Right.
So I think that we would really be able to improve, you know, the quality of care. We would be able to move, for instance, to an electronic medical record that was the same among all institutions, so that if my patient got sick in San Francisco, they would have access to my medical record. And I think that would really improve the quality of care in the United States.
And I know you have some background in public health. Are there broader, even population health benefits?
Sure. You know, we would be able, in fact, to have universal coverage of preventive interventions. You know, already the ACA tried to get us there around things like vaccines. And, you know, those kinds of preventive measures.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that, you know, a national health insurance program would really be the way to get there for everybody.
So Senator Sanders puts this bill out. It's aspirational at the very least. But we're in a system now where we kind of have a mixed system. We have some private insurance. We have some public programs of various kinds. We have a bunch of people who are still uninsured and some who are underinsured, as you say. So how does this bill contemplate getting us from where we are now to this new system?
Well, on one level, you know, if everybody is eligible, it should be possible to make that transition fairly rapidly. You know, you look at the Medicare program. When it was passed, it was implemented for over 16 million people in a period of 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Sanders has put in a much longer transition period, which I'm not sure is altogether necessary. Yes, there would have to be a way of dealing with the insurance industry,
mm-hmm.
Whether one would, you know, do some kind of payoff there for
mm-hmm.
them
mm-hmm.
is a matter that would have to be discussed.
Mm-hmm.
More important, if you're going to reduce the administrative costs, you're going to, in fact, deal with people who, you know, no longer have jobs in the
mm-hmm.
insurance industry, or in my office, or in the hospital's administrative structure.
Right.
And so the Sanders bill and, frankly, the Conyers bill, which we'll talk about in a moment, allow for, you know, a way to support job retraining for many of those people so there wouldn't be real job loss. And that would be part of what goes on during the transition period.
He also talks about a Medicare buy-in option, so you sort of step toward Medicare out of your current coverage.
Right. he puts that in this four-year transition period. Again, PNHP has argued we should think in terms of a shorter period
mm-hmm.
Because there might be a huge turmoil in that process if we don't kind of say, well, this is going to happen in a year's time. And we're going to have to solve the problems rapidly. You know, buying into Medicare has the quality of a public option
mm-hmm.
situation. And there, again, I really worry that the private health insurance industry in the short term will try to shift all of those really sick patients into, you know, that public option.
Right.
Medicare.
Try to game the
buy-in.
System to their advantage.
That's correct. Gaming the system.
So let's talk a little bit in our few minutes. We've got about 4 or 5 minutes left. The politics around this. You spent some time earlier in your career working on Capitol Hill. How do you see this kind of potentially playing out moving forward in the Congress?
Okay, yeah. I was a Robert Wood Johnson Health Policy Fellow. It should be said that this was during the Clinton health care reform period. And I have to admit that they didn't really deal with single payer at that time at all.
They didn't listen to you.
They did around some issues, by the way. But what was interesting there, what you began to see the process. The Clinton bill was introduced into the House. Mm-hmm. It was introduced into the Senate. The problem was that it was all formulated by Mrs. Clinton and health policy wonks. We are talking about a situation where we now have a bill actually in the Senate, and we have one in the House. It's called H.R. 676, or the Conyers bill. Mm-hmm. So we have two bills that are there already.
They're pretty similar.
And they're pretty similar. They need to be refined, and so forth. But we're at a place where it's not as if this is being handed to Congress, by a whole bunch of policy wonks. It's something that is developing. So probably what we would see is, committee hearings, in both houses of Congress. An ability to amend things there, and then a conference committee between House and Senate that would come forward with a final bill.
And hopefully by then we'd have a president in the White House who'd be willing to sign it.
That's right. absolutely correct.
Exactly. So we got a few years to pull this all together. We've been talking in this month's program about Senator Sanders' new Medicare for All bill. It's a universal health care bill that's got a lot of public support and attention, I must say, and a lot of buzz around it.
Right. Now, the question is, what can people who are watching this show do?
Right.
Okay? And I would like to mention that I think, number one, they should, in fact, be calling or emailing or writing a letter to Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, who has signed on
from New York,
essentially, and she's from New York. She's somebody that we really should praise for actually doing this.
Right.
We also should be writing to Senator Schumer and saying, come on, get on board here. This is one way in which we can really help the Democratic Party, frankly. Okay.
And you're listening to WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. And I'm sitting here in studio with two beautiful people in front of me, and we're going to have a very interesting conversation about art and life and meaning. And joining me are Ast May. She is a jazz singer, poet, dancer. She's traveled to China and Japan, and she loves life and people. And that's what we're all about right here. And also joining us in studio, and most specifically, Tariq Sultan. He's one of the world's best-known pioneers of male oriental dance in the world and has been the most vocal advocate for the validity of male oriental dancers. His articles on their role both in the professional and social arenas throughout history in the cultures of the Middle East and North Africa has been translated into several languages. He is also known for adamantly acknowledging the dance not as a generic form of entertainment, but as a cultural and historic product of the Egyptian people and their neighbors. He believes strongly that in order to understand the dance in its proper cultural and historical context, the focus of attention needs to be on the dance traditions of the ordinary people, which form the foundation of the Oriental dance of the professional entertainers. Tariq's introduction to Oriental dance began with his love of Arabic music. As a child, after many years of listening to the various styles of music from Egypt, Lebanon, and Turkey, he decided it would be fun to dance to it. In 1985, he began studying and researching Oriental dance. In 1988, he traveled to Egypt for the first time where he saw not only the legendary stars such as Soher Zaki and Nagwa Faoud, but the dance as done by the ordinary people, which is the foundation of the performance style. He began his teaching career in the early 90s while continually expanding his knowledge and understanding of the dance. Over the years, his talent and dedication to the art earned him a reputation as a dynamic performer and patient, inspiring teacher and choreographer. He has taught and performed across the USA as well as the UK, Japan, Turkey, Morocco, Egypt, Jerusalem, Australia, Trinidad, and Argentina. In 2003, he became one of the first male dancers to perform at the Alhan Washahan Festival in Cairo, Egypt. He has also performed at the United States Lincoln Center and the Museum of Natural History. Tariq continues to teach and perform regularly in the New York, New Jersey area. He has also been a featured performer in some of the top nightclubs in New York City, such as Cabo Rouge, Mejanada, Horus, the Habibi Lounge, 1001 Nights, and countless private functions. You can learn more about him by visiting his website at TariqSultan.net, T-A-R-I-K. S-U-L-T-A-N, TariqSultan.net, and view his videos online at YouTube by searching under his name as well, Tariq Sultan. So I have to say, my goodness, I'm impressed. Welcome to the show. Hello.
Hi.
Ast, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good, too. Now, Ast is the one that inspired me to invite Tariq, so I invited you here as well, because you have studied with Tariq.
Yes.
And I was really very impressed by the things that Ast had to say about you. But before getting into that, let's have you say hello.
Hello, Tariq, everybody.
And thank you for joining us today. So what I would love for you to talk about, I mean, your bio was very thorough, but really give us a sense of the world of dance in which you were in, this experience of traveling and dancing and teaching Oriental dance.
Well, at the time that I became involved in dance. Well, there still is, but there really is a big network all around the world of people who are interested in Egyptian dance, or what Americans would call belly dancing. Mm-hmm. So practically every country you go, there's a community. And all across the United States, in every major city and town, there is some kind of community happening. Nowadays, there's been an evolution in the dance form outside of Egypt. There's all kinds of fusion styles that have come about. But for me, my original, as it says in my bio, my original inspiration was the traditional music and dance. And so I would spend a lot of time in the Lincoln Center Dance Research Library combing through old videos, articles, magazines, trying to find everything that I could in order to understand it. Because at the time when I got involved in it, people really had a very skewed perception of what the dance was all about. You hear the term belly dance, and, you know, you think of a woman in a skimpy outfit, you know, mm-hmm. wiggling around and... back then, I think things have changed for the better now, but back then, people thought it was like striptease, you know? Mm-hmm. And I was really inspired to share with people the reality of the dance. And in a lot of ways, it coincided with my evolution as a person of African descent, coming into a knowledge and understanding of my people's history. and seeing the way we had been exploited and what's the word I'm looking for?
Colonized?
Colonized, yes, but misrepresented.
Okay.
In the media. You know, growing up as a child, the only references I saw to Africa were Tarzan movies. Mm. You know, I hope I'm not dating myself.
I'm afraid you are, but that's okay, because everyone in the room remembers.
Yeah, you know, so that was the only idea. And I remember even being in junior high school in history class, and the global studies professor made the statement that civilization originated in the Middle East and then gradually moved north. So you're sitting there in the classroom and you're looking at this whole world map, and okay, so what's below the Middle East, the place where your people come from? And basically you're being told that your people had no history, had no culture, no civilization. And I realized that that wasn't true quite by accident, because there was nothing in school that taught me any different. It was hanging out in the library in school that I found an old book on the shelf, like an old dusty book, like probably wrote it when God made dirt. And it was talking about the West African empires. And I'd always been a history buff. I loved history. And so it kind of blew my mind, like, wow, there was history and civilization in Africa. Like, you know, the only thing you see on TV is starving kids and all kinds of madness and mayhem. So that opened my mind, and I began to study even more. And, you know, you go through a process of evolution, and I think the first stage in that evolution is anger. You know, you're angry because of the way that you've been misrepresented and lied about and lied to. And so when I came to dance, it was like, well, here's another group of people who are really misrepresented, and their culture is being distorted in a similar way. And I wanted people to know, you know, like, I fell in love with this thing that was so beautiful, and I wanted people to know about it. I thought that it deserved attention. And so I began taking classes. At first, I only wanted to dance for my own fun. But as I began to research more and find out just how rich it was, I was like, why doesn't everybody know about this? So I figured, okay, well, make a long story short, the best way to let people know is to show them. Mm-hmm. So little by little, I began performing, and that ended up like opening up a whole other can of worms. But, you know, I didn't think about that at the time. I just jumped in. And so that was really my motivation from the beginning. Was there was a lot of things. It was, you know, multifaceted. So on the one hand, yes, there was that awareness that there's this beautiful art form that I love, right? Because it was an opportunity for me to escape a whole lot of negativity. Growing up in the Bronx in the mid-80s, those of you that are old enough to remember, that's when all hell broke loose. You know, it was like the rug was pulled out from under us.
I remember. I lived there.
Yeah, you know, and so it was like one day you're living in, you know, working class, middle class neighborhoods. And then the next day, it's like everything just flipped. And now we've got gang wars, and we've got crackheads, and then the AIDS epidemic came out. It was a very frightful time to be alive. And so music and dance was something positive in my life. It gave me an opportunity to escape all of the craziness that was around me and all the hopelessness and despair that was around me. At the same time, being in your physical body and learning how to take control of your body was also very empowering for me, because I come from a culture where big is beautiful, or at least it was at that time, and I was anything but. And so, you know, people used to make fun of me all the time because I was very skinny. And I didn't understand why my grandparents were always taking me to all kinds of doctors and healers and everything. And, you know, and then I, like, looked at some of my pictures and it's like, well, you did look like a poster child for Feed the Children. So that's probably why they were so afraid. But the message that that gave me was, it really caused me to develop a sense of low self-esteem. And so to be able to do something, to take control over my body and to do something beautiful with it was incredibly empowering. And it was the first stages in learning to build my self-esteem, which was like, on a scale of 1 to 10, it was like a 0. Mm-hmm. You know, so there were a lot of things happening at the same time that went into me putting all of my passion into dance.
Beautiful. So tell us a little something about what we don't know about this kind of dance. Because truthfully, I know very little.
You know, there's so much. You know, like I said, that part of the world, even today, there's still so much misunderstanding about it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Within the dance community itself, there was always a fascination in trying to figure out where the dance came from. Where did belly dance come from? What is its origins? You know, back in the day, I guess in America, we were introduced to it like in the 1960s. At that time, there were a lot of clubs, Greek and Turkish clubs, and that was the way most Americans were introduced to it. But in actuality, the origins of the dance itself does come from Egypt. And people have this misconception about Egypt yesterday and today, a lot of people, that Egypt somehow is not a part of Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Like somehow or another, it's just like floating in the ether there, and then there's Africa. No, it's a part of Africa. It always has been. But if you look at the way the dance is put together, the movement vocabulary, if you try to put it in this thing that they call the Middle East, it really makes no sense, right? Because here's this dance that is so atypical to everything that we're used to seeing in the Western world, where dance is moving through space and you're using your arms and your legs and you're jumping and you're hopping and running around. And here's this thing where you're really not moving around a whole lot, and it's all in the hips and the torsos and everything else but the feet. So it's an anomaly. And so people try to figure out, well, why people come up with this weird way of moving. And so they created all kinds of stereotypes about fertility rituals and goddess worship and all of this. But if you are in Egypt and your outlook, like I said, is towards the Mediterranean or towards Western Asia, it doesn't make sense. But if you turn around and you look at Egypt's backyard,
mm-hmm.
which is all the rest of Africa, then it makes sense. Because as African people all across Africa, I mean, Africa is an incredibly diverse continent, you know. Unfortunately, in the West, we kind of think of Africa as a country when it's not. It's a continent. And it's full of a great deal of diversity in every way imaginable, physical, cultural, linguistic. But there are certain things that, there are certain common denominators that you will find all across the continent. And one of those common threads is the way that Africans relate to the body in terms of musical expression. Whereas in most of the world, the focus is on the arms and the legs exclusively. In Africa, we dance with the entire body.
Mm-hmm.
We use the hands, we use the legs, we use the arms, we use the torso, we use the hips. Everything moves. So when you look at the rest of Africa, when you look at Somalia, you look at Kenya, you look at Uganda, you look at Congo, you look at South Africa, even countries in West Africa, and you look in the African diaspora, you see a lot of similarities. You see that all across the continent, there is a common thread, and that is the focus of movement is the center of the body, the torso, the hips. And, you know, like growing up, when I started learning the dance, I noticed, well, there's, you know, some things here that look similar to the way, you know, this looks like calypso, this looks like bomba plena, this looks like... looks like the way we dance, you know, to reggae. Mm-hmm. But I didn't make the connection because you are programmed to believe that Egypt is this thing called the Middle East and that it's really more Asian than African. But when you take a look at the rest of the continent and you look at Egyptian dance, you notice, well, everybody's got the same elements here that they're working with, but the way they put it together is what gives it its own identity. So what we see in Egypt is a local variation on a theme that is found across the continent. Mm-hmm. And then when you look at the other countries in North Africa as well, you know, Tunisia, Libya, am I missing anybody? Algeria, Morocco. It makes sense. You see the same thing. It's like everybody has the same ingredients, but the way they're putting it together gives it its individual character. And so it forced me to reevaluate the way we think about this place called Egypt, that it's not that this dance came from Africa to Egypt. It's that Egypt also is a part of Africa. And so all of these places share a common root, a common origin. And science has told us now within our lifetimes, we know that all human life, the human family itself, originated in Africa. And from there, they spread out across the rest of the continent mm-hmm. and the rest of the world. So it only stands to reason that because they all... every culture that you find in Africa once belonged to a single family before the human family split up and started migrating in its mm-hmm. different ways. And so it shouldn't come as a surprise that what you see in Egypt, you also see similar things in Congo, in Uganda, in Somalia and Eritrea and all these places. And as far as the rest of the Middle East, you know, I mentioned like Turkey and mm-hmm. Greece, and also you find it in Lebanon. Well, if you look on the map, Palestine, Jordan, Lebanon, they're all right there, right beside Egypt. And if you look in ancient history, Egypt for thousands of years had a cultural influence on these regions. And the way it made sense to me is looking at Eastern Mediterranean, their folkloric styles of dancing. It's a completely different approach to the body. Their style of dancing is called debke, which is a line dance, and it involves a lot of intricate movements, you know, and steps of the feet. Mm-hmm. And then you have this other thing. So it's like looking at the size of the Eastern Mediterranean and looking at the vastness of the African continent, and you're seeing this torso-driven way of moving all across Africa, and then in this other tiny little corner of the Eastern Mediterranean, well, where did it come from, you know? Mm-hmm. Had to flow from west to east. So, yeah, I mean, this is also an African dance. Yes, the people in Egypt today have an Arabic identity, which is a whole different thing than being an Arab, but that's a whole another discussion, you know, because of, well, you know, it's similar to Mexico, right?
Right.
The Spanish came, they imposed their language, and that's why everybody in Mexico speaks Spanish now, and they consider themselves Latinos, but they had an ancestry that was always there before the Spanish came. So, yeah, these people came in, they settled, they mixed, they mingled, whatever, but it didn't eradicate what was there before. And the same thing exists in Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, over the course of its existence, Egypt was subject not only to colonizations, but also to migration, you know, because mm-hmm. it was the America, it was the USA of its day. So people were attracted to it because of its prosperity, and they were absorbed mm-hmm. into the population. And yes, with conquest came the imposition of different languages and different cultures. But there's still a substratum there that is indigenous. And when you look at certain things that Egyptians do, even today, you see that they're tied with the rest of the African continent. So even today, if you know what you're looking at and you know where to look, you will find connections to the rest of Africa. And there are a lot of things that existed in ancient Egypt that are no longer there, but you can find them in other parts of Africa today.
Beautiful. So I'd like to speak also about your dancing and your teaching. So I thought I'd bring in Ast May to tell us a bit about her experience in your classroom as one of your most praising students, I would say. She's So, and then you could talk about your teaching a bit. Mm-hmm. Go ahead. Yeah. Tell us about your experience in the classes.
I was sitting here listening to him, and he was talking about how certain forms of dance, you only move, like, you know, your legs and your arms. And I do remember him always telling us, you move your whole body. You know, he's always directing us as to how to move, and he's a very patient teacher. So if you have two left feet and whatever, you know, he can really work with you. I came to belly dance via a doctor that I had. He recommended it because I had fibroids. He said it would help to shrink them. And so I just seek belly dancing, and I looked it up, and I found Tyreek. And, I mean, it's been a journey from when I first met him to where he is now. But he is very patient. He is very supportive of women, which I love. He's always telling us in class, you are beautiful. You own your space and, you know, shine your light to the world. And I just feel very fortunate to know him. He really helps you to, like, gain a confidence, but he's not like how some people will push you and, like, kind of, you know, make you do it. He's a loving force. He encourages you and coaxes you to do dance and to move and to enjoy. And, I mean, dancing in his class for me has been, like, every week it would be just like my dance. Like, some people go outside and dance. I would be there, and that would be my experience to have fun and enjoy the class and dance in class.
Mm-hmm. And how would you say that it's helped you in terms of, you know, your sense of self and your sense of confidence to be able to do this kind of dancing?
I've seen myself grow from the beginning to this point now. Was hard for me at first because, like he said, in this country we have that idea that belly dance is this, you know, kind of almost
sexual,
like a stripper thing, mm-hmm. you know. And he explained that it's not that, it's dance, it's beautiful. I'm a woman of a certain size, and because of that, you think that I always loved to dance. And I wanted to, and coming to his class made me, like, realize that I am a dancer and that I can do it. I would be doing dances and movements that I didn't really realize that I could do. And he would always tell me, like, wow, you know, like, you really have great moves and you should be dancing on stage. And I'm gathering more of that strength and confidence to do that kind of dancing because I love it.
Beautiful. I'm tempted to say that I love that. It sounds wonderful. I've always looked at it and felt intrigued by that, like you said, that flexibility of the body, and also being someone who grew up not being, I won't say I'm not petite, I am petite in some ways, but I've never been thin. And I've always felt the need to cover up, you know, wear an extra jacket, even if it's summertime, because I have this insecurity about my body that I probably have had since my teen years.
And so we have to end that excerpt here, because I wanted to have a chance to tell you how to connect with our dancer healer, Tariq Sultan. And his website is TariqSultan.net. TariqSultan.net. I found him to be a very gentle soul, very enchanting, and I believe heals through his dance. He's having a fundraising event on Sunday, November 12th from 2 p.m. till 5 p.m. The location is Jeban, New York City, 15 St. Mark's Place in New York, 10003. That's 15 St. Mark's Place, Sunday, November 12th, 2 to 5 p.m. On his website, you can find more about his classes, and I encourage you to do that. Thank you for joining us. Stay tuned for Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund.
Going through a process.
Oops.
Learning to love myself. And I saw these women coming into my classes, and...
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and, yes, the imagination. With us, well, we'll introduce everybody shortly as we get things set up, but like a phoenix, Omni Magazine. Oh, come on, just stay tuned.
It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. And I feel fine.
Ellen was only at Wall Street and up in Harlem, and now here on Atlantic Avenue. Rob, say hello.
Hello there, everyone.
Ah, there you are. Hi.
Hey there.
Oh, okay.
Did you hear me?
Yes, but I think we have you on lag. I think you're on delay.
Can you hear us?
Can I do anything about that?
We need a better Skype connection. The one here at WBAI, I think the word is allowed by the FCC, sucks. Rob?
I just turned off my video connection. Maybe that'll help.
Yeah, that actually does help, because now I'm not seeing you in about a five-second lag.
All right, so are we good?
Yeah, except there still is the lag, but audio lag is better than video lag.
Yeah, just try to say whatever you would say 2 seconds from now.
Did you hear
you
that?
2 seconds before you ask?
Yes.
Yeah, so just everything you would say 2 seconds earlier.
I'll do my very best.
Yes, exactly, and that's how it works. Because the theme of the first new issue is time. Oh, and that tells me what songs I need to cue up. Okay, good. Exactly. How did that and Simon and Garfunkel?
Oh, yeah.
Hazy Shade of Winter. Yeah, those are the two great time songs as far as I'm concerned. Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. I said that. I should have also said that this is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM and over at WBAI.org and Facebook Live, where you're mostly seeing Pam Weintraub, and to her left, oh, let's move Rob over. Rob is a monitor. There we are. Now you can see Ellen Datlow. Ellen is a frequent visitor to the show, probably next month as well. I have to find my Alice songs, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's a You'll find out. There isn't a person on this show that I've had like last month who doesn't say, you know, Rick Bowes, this one and that one. I was wrong about Cassandra Caw, who she sold something else to you, but it wasn't for the Alice book.
No.
Right. She's amazing.
She was on the show?
Yeah, I had her on last time she was here, thanks to you, mm-hmm. because the KGB Fantastic Fiction series was all booked, and you sent her to me, and I can't thank you enough, because she was at the New York Review of Science Fiction readings, and she was in-bleeping credible. She was great, and she's a really neat person, and she's going to be around in December, and you'll see her at my place in December, in fact. And I'll probably have her on the show again, because, well, she also knows, what is it called, Muay Guan karate, or it's a martial art, you know.
Actually, I didn't know that.
Yeah, oh yes, she does. Ellen, tap your microphone, please.
Uh-oh, another one?
Yeah, I think it's dead.
Uh-oh.
I found out why.
You didn't turn them on?
No, I did, but I didn't. But now they're on.
They're on now? You can
yes,
hear
they're
me?
On now.
Okay.
Yes, we can hear you better. Before we heard everybody through my mic. Mm-hmm. But no, somebody turned. Okay, you see there are these.